Oh, what is a constant gardener?
It's a man who doesn't ever stop gardening.
But in the movie The Constant Gardener, there's huge swathes of the movie where he's not gardening.
Yeah, it is. I also had the same thought. Is this adapted from a book?
I hate to get ahead of us, but it's adapted from the book of the same name by John le Carré.
Right. It's called by John le Carré?
No, it's called The Constant Gardener.
Right. I wonder if there's more gardening in the book.
Well, you'd like to think. I imagine there's lots of little moments where our hero drifts off and talks about gardening. Do you think in the book, The Constant Gardener, the chat about gardening and rooting out the weeds and digging through the soil is in some way metaphorical for some kind of wider malaise?
Well, I wonder. And do you think the film would have been better if they were able to land their original desire for the Ralph Fiennes protagonist role?
Who was that then?
Well, I assume it was Paul Bottany.
Oh, mother of pearl. I think we should wrap this up for a short episode because things are not going to get better than that. Well, having said that, you know actually who they wanted to play for the Rachel Weisz character in the film The Constant Gardener?
Who?
It was Emma Stone. Because, you know, you get stones in gardens, don't you?
In the garden.
In the garden. Yeah.
Well, I actually thought you were going to say that it was... is it Catherine Moss? What's her name?
Oh, I like it. Emma Moss.
Emma Moss. Or Kate Moss. Emma Moss.
Kate Moss is in The Constant Gardener.
The Constant Gardener. And Pete Doherty's just hanging around in the back. In the back.
What is her? She's a moss. Of course, they went back in time and they said to a young Joaquin Phoenix before he changed his name, and they said, "Leaf Phoenix, would you like to be in the movie A Constant Gardener?"
There you go.
And he said, "Yes, please." "You do know I'm going to change my name to Joaquin." And they went, "Forget it. Fuck off, Joaquin. We don't want anything to do with it unless you're called Leaf." Well, that's it.
That's right. That's right. I actually thought that they were going to cast Bud Malone as one of the characters in the film.
Bud Malone? Who's Bud Malone?
Yeah, that's a real person, isn't it? Let me just check. Bud Malone? Yeah, Bud Malone is a real person.
Well, really, who they wanted for the Rachel Weisz character was Rose McGowan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's...
From Scream.
That is a lot better.
That was, of course, because, you know, that's...
God damn it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm using my brain and I can see you looking at your screen.
No, I'm looking to see if Bud Malone is a real person. Good, that's literally it.
Yeah, it can't really be. It sounds like the name of a movie.
No, it's a real... Bud Malone's a real person. Look, Bud Malone's IMDb page, known for one episode as played himself... In Trauma, Life in ER.
Okay. Well, how did it come into your head when we were horsing around with actor names?
I don't know. I think maybe there's a different Bud. My mind went from through Stalk, through Petal, and then I was thinking, well, Petal Guardiola doesn't work. He's not even an actor.
No, you've got Mulch. So. Gardening. I have actually been gardening today. I'm not joking. I've been in the back garden and the front garden area, digging up some dead rose bush.
Right.
It's kind of the trunk. Yeah. The trunk.
Right. But that's enough about...
That's enough about me and my wife in the bedroom.
My wife, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host, and Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
Hello. And welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast. With me, your host, A damn rich mundo. And I do need to say it like that, especially today, because I'm feeling a little bit blue. My name is actually, in reality, Adam Richmond.
Reality is whatever you make it.
I'm sure the listener knows what I'm really called. This is the show where we talk about the movies or films that we'd forgot that we'd even seen in the first place.
Weed.
And when I say weed, I mean mead and me, Miko Gardner in crime, yeah. Mr. Joe Devine. Yeah.
Well, hello there. I've brought my shears and my gloves, and I've brought some knee pads, and I'm ready to just get a hell of a lot of work done on the lawn.
Reese Shearsmith would have been a marvelous side character, perhaps the Danny Houston.
Yeah. Well, also like Danny Garden Glover would have been quite a good. You know, that would have been fun.
That would have been fun. But no, we can't do that. No, the game's gone. On today's episode, we are doing the 2005 kind of whistleblower flick, for want of a better word.
Man, this is a straight up corporate thriller.
It's a straight up corporate whistleblower flick.
Well, it's not straight up, but it is. They're the words.
It's dressed actually. It's not straight up. It's dressed up in worthy yeah. Big Pharma African clothes, whatever they look like.
I think they look like the colonial wear that, you know, happened around the 30s.
Oh dear, I feel like I'm tying myself in all kinds of knots. Mm-hmm. This, of course, was directed by Fernando Meirelles. It's 129 minutes.
You're moving straight past Meirelles.
Meirelles. Me old mate Fernando Meirelles. How do you say it?
Meirelles. Morelles.
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 I mean, to be honest, he's Brazilian, so it'll be like Morelles.
Morelles.
If he was Portuguese, they'd go Morelles. But because he's Brazilian, it'll be like Morelles or something like that.
So this stars Ranulph Fiennes.
That's Rudolf Fiennes, yeah.
No, it stars Ralph Fiennes, Ralph Rachel Fiennes, Weisz, yep,
got it.
Danny Houston, Bill Nye, he and Pete Postlethwaite.
Oh, Pete's back. Big Pete's back.
Peter Postlethwaite. I absolutely totally forgot that Peter Postlethwaite was in this with a horribly, horribly thick South African accent. And that's coming from someone who's just done Billy Connolly for 5 minutes very badly.
And Donald Sumter's in it, who I thought was Terrence Stamp for some of the film, and now I'm realising it's not.
Yeah, no, I like that guy. He's good. It is based on the book of the same name by John le Carré, The Constant Gardener. And here is the letterboxed blurb. Love. At any cost. Justin Quayle, Ralph Fiennes, is a low-level British diplomat who has always gone about his work very quietly, not causing any problems. But after his radical wife, Tessa, Rachel Weisz, is killed, he becomes determined to find out why. Thrusting himself into the middle of a very dangerous conspiracy. I'll tell you what, if my radical wife was killed, I'd bloody put my feet up and have a cup of tea. anyway, oh God, I'm in a silly mood today, Joe. Sorry, that's the movie.
That's yeah, that's it. Can I read the IMDb? It's a little shorter.
Oh, okay, yeah.
A widower's transcontinental quest to find answers about his wife's death leads him to explosive secrets. Very different.
Not explosive, but yeah, very different.
Not that explosive. But then, I don't know, is it? I wonder. We look back, don't we? We look back on the 2000s or whatever this was.
There was no explosions in this movie. And also the secrets.
That's true.
The secrets that Big Pharma have been up to no good were about as explosive as my diarrhea I had last year after eating some dodgy mushrooms.
Was that not very explosive then?
No, they just trickled out.
It was dribble. It was dribblage. Yeah, got it.
You got me on this. And also, but you also said there was a 10% chance that you hadn't actually seen it in the first place. You watched it today. Can you confirm or deny whether you feel like you've seen this movie?
Turns out I'd never seen it before. I think I thought I had.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought I had, but I hadn't.
Well, I think that's what makes Constant Gardener such a plummy movie you forgot. It's a movie you forgot you even hadn't seen in the first place.
That's right. But you had seen it, right?
Oh, I'd seen it. I saw it cinema at the time with my then girlfriend, who's now not my girlfriend.
Oh. Did it bring back any memories or?
No, well, it did actually. This is really silly. I remember after the movie saying to my then girlfriend, I remember saying, making some kind of, I thought it in my head was caked and clothed in irony. I said my favourite bit of the movie was when Rachel Weisz got out of the bath, heavily pregnant in the movie, and she's toweling herself off. And there's a flashback. It's one in a flashback, and one kind of feels like in real time. And it's very rare in a movie to see someone properly towel themselves off. And Rachel Weisz goes to dry the crack of her ass.
Yeah.
Right. Which I think that's the only time that's happened in mainstream Hollywood cinema.
I've certainly never seen it before. Yeah. I've seen in comedic films, I've seen characters kind of like do the flossing of between the legs with towel, one hand either side, but not like this.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I'd love for someone to give me a list of other moments, but then that would make it seem like I just want to see that.
So this guy's into keyhole surgery.
Yeah, that's what I really want. No, and I remember thinking, oh, it's quite a human, intimate, moment, and it's in the background of a scene. And I remember saying that to my then girlfriend, and I think she took it in a bawdy fashion, like I was sexualizing it, and she didn't speak to me for much of the rest of that evening.
Really? I mean, that's fair enough, I would say, because you are quite a bawdy guy.
But there's things I say, and then there's things of how I meant, and I didn't mean it in a bawdy way. And I hate to be misrepresented.
No, he's such a... This guy's a real room and board guy, you know? Yeah, it's a good bit of the film. I like that bit. But I like it because it represents a very kind of ultra-realistic coupledom. You know, it's a fantastic moment because, you know, Rachel Weisz is a very attractive woman. She's also pregnant in this scene in the bath. You know, there's an intimacy to sort of toweling your bum in a way that isn't sexy, but also kind of is at the same time. Do you know what I mean? There's like it's very messy. The scene is very messy, and it reflects coupledom and closeness and intimacy very well. So it's of note, I think, that we haven't seen that in more films, because with one action, you create a scene that for people who have been in long-term relationships is very familiar and, you know, speaks to a certain level of comfort. And it tells you an awful lot about the relationship that these two people have without a hell of a lot of action.
Right. The strength of this film lies in Fernando Meirelles.
Meirelles nuts.
Meirelles, these nuts. A lot of it is shot in Kenya.
Yeah.
He shoots a lot of real people, real situations. Ralph Fiennes is wandering around speaking to people in Kenya, looking, asking questions, doing a bit of detective work.
Ralph Fiennes.
And it feels like Fernando has gone out there with a view to capture the what's really going on there. And it doesn't have any Hollywood gloss to it. And so it's possibly the only interesting thing about the movie. Do we need to say anything else about the movie before we like talk about it? Like it's really like, because I wouldn't recommend this movie to anyone. I wouldn't recommend anyone watch it. Would you recommend to anyone watch this?
I don't know. I will say because I think a lot of people won't have seen this, that I know we did the synopsis already, but essentially Ralph Fiennes plays a diplomat whose job is kind of boring and or unclear. He marries, you know, this younger woman in Rachel Weisz, who you learn from the opening scene is, you know, a young sort of ideological revolutionary. They move to Kenya, having not known each other for that long. They get married. She's pregnant. She loses the baby. Anyway, essentially the thrust of the story is that she, in her unemployed role as the wife of this diplomat, she befriends a local doctor and then goes on a mission to uncover this conspiracy of a big pharmaceutical company kind of partnering with various other stakeholders to test dangerous drugs on the local populations in and around Nairobi. Anyway, it costs Rachel Weisz her life, and the whole back end of the film is him kind of trying to uncover what happened to finish her work for her. That's the film, but it's very slow. The pacing is so confusing. But one thing I will say is like that my wife and I paused it with what we assumed would be 10 minutes to go, and there was 40 minutes left, and I had no clue how that was the case. I didn't know where I was in the film. I really struggled to follow the structure of it. I followed what was happening, but I was completely lost at sea with no anchor, and I couldn't understand how there could possibly be 40 minutes left of the film, and yet there was. What I thought would be something much more about introspection and much more about thoughts and feelings turned out to actually be a corporate thriller where the plot did matter, despite it not mattering at all for the first sort of 40 minutes of the film. So there are elements within that I really liked, and there are bits that I wish that I could share with people. However, I don't think, on balance, I would recommend this film to anybody. I would recommend City of God, which is Fernando Morales' main film, the film that he made before this, because I think that's a wonderful film and worth watching. I didn't know that The Constant Gardener was directed by the same director until the credits rolled at the end. So wasn't watching it with that in mind either, which I think is interesting. But there are some things that are stunning about this film, but there are nowhere near enough of them for it to be recommendable, I think.
For too long I've been parched of thirst and unable to quench it. Too long I've been starving to death and haven't died. I feel nothing. Not the wind on my face, nor the spray of the sea. You best start believing in ghost stories, Miss Turner. You're in one.
Well, let me ask you a question about Ralph Fiennes then, right? Because I think his performance in this film is really interesting. I am biased because I love Ralph Fiennes. I think he's the greatest living actor. He's certainly my favourite. And one of the main reasons I believed fully that I had seen this film is because Ralph Fiennes is in the film and I know that. So therefore, I feel like I've seen it, right? You'll always get an interesting performance from Ralph Fiennes. You can hang your hat on that. The question I think sometimes is whether or not it's right for the film, you know, and I'm not sure anything would have been right for this film because it's a confusing mixture of things. So in some ways, the most impressive thing about it for me is the Ralph Fiennes performance. I say that with note that Rachel Weisz won an Oscar for this film, which I think is very confusing.
2005. Oh, I wonder what else, what other movies are knocking about in 2005.
So she did. She won at the 78th Academy Awards. Rachel Weisz won Best Supporting Actress for The Constant Gardener against Amy Adams in Junebug in her breakout role.
There was so much buzz for Adams in Junebug.
Catherine Keener for Capote, which is a movie you forgot if there ever has been one, by the way. I mean,
she deserved an Oscar at some point, and if not then, that was her. That was when.
Then when, yeah. Frances McDormand, who already had one, obviously, at that time, but was in North Country.
No,
I don't think I've seen that film.
Disappeared.
And Michelle Williams for Brokeback Mountain, who I think was the other sort of strong contender that year, but
oh come on, Williams, she pips Weisz.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I found that interesting because Rachel Weisz, I actually don't really like her performance in the film. Maybe that's controversial to say.
No.
I don't know. I mean, I don't particularly love the character, but also. And it's hard to know like how she's playing it.
Well, I mean, Le Carré would have spent pages and pages and pages of explaining how they got together and the little mini compromises of what brought them together. a movie, this movie, is already fucking far too long. It's 140 mins. It's got to get them together, and it's got to get them to Africa.
It's got to get them together immediately.
They get together immediately, and he's so dewy-eyed for her. And you're like, what? Yeah. And she says, can I come to, let's get married, I'll come to Africa with you. And he says yes. And you're like, what? What? Come on, mate. She's a fucking car crash. She's going to absolutely fuck up all your shit. And the question of the movie for the first two-thirds is...
Is she having an affair?
It's not just, is she having an affair? It's like, does she really love him? Is what they have real? And he has these doubts. And there is something interesting in that. Like, I'd like to watch the actual relationship drama about that.
Yeah.
And it really be about that. Maybe she disappears.
When you find out that she loved him anyway, the whole time, it's just, that's really boring. That's the most boring element of the film. You're absolutely right. I love the idea that she's out there and the film plays her as this, is this character who, at one point in the film, you think, is she having sex with four different people? You know, is this, could this be real? That there's an interesting notion in that of a slightly older man who is played as boring and played as, you know, not on her level, trying to hold on to this thing. That would be quite fun. That's not what the film is, obviously.
No, and then also, as much as Fernando doesn't want it to appear Hollywood, at its beating heart, it's so Hollywood, because it can't possibly have the Rachel Weisz character betray Ralph Fiennes' character. She's always pure and she's loved him. Like, and that the film has teased you into thinking that maybe she did, but no. And so it's a Hollywood bollocks.
And the Oscar goes to Cameron Crowe for Almost Famous.
This is the first Academy Award and third nomination for Cameron Crowe. In 1996, he was a double nominee for Best Picture and Original Screenplay for Jerry Maguire.
Oh, man.
Hi, everybody. I'm Cameron.
Back to Fiennes.
I think the interesting thing about Fiennes is that, as we said, he does something unusual and unexpected, at the very least interesting, in the role. He plays it in a very subtle and very understated way. At the opening, as described, when he meets Rachel Weisz in those early scenes where he's chatting with colleagues, he's almost polite to the extent of not being there. You know, he has, in some ways, he has both like very minimal and then also quite maximal screen presence by doing sort of virtually nothing and playing this in a ultra realistic way. But I think it's one of the things that for me saves the film and makes it more interesting, because he's playing this British diplomat who will have, you know, and we know that the kind of the work that Ralph Fiennes will put into the character, he will understand instinctively that this man will be a victim of that type of British restraint that will prevent him from feeling anything. There's a scene in the film where he hears that his wife is dead, and the first thing that he does is thank the colleague that told him and expressly understands that must have been a difficult thing to do. You know, that's there to show us that this character is a British man with who's emotionally repressed and is very, very restrained. I think one thing you could say, Put it this way, and I'll be curious to see where you land on this spectrum. One end of the spectrum is, this is a really, really interesting way of playing a character like this in a film like this, bucking expectation, and doing, you know, this is the kind of thing that only Ralph Fiennes would do and still keep it interesting. The other end of the spectrum is that he plays it in a way that is too withdrawn for the audience to really grasp and really follow. Also, his transformation, as I said earlier, is so internal that you don't really see any of it play out on the screen. You just see this character kind of change halfway through the film. I'm not saying it happens suddenly, I'm just saying that it's so interior that it makes it kind of hard to see cinematically. And some of the best actors, or maybe this is some of the best movie stars, are open and expressive and take you with them as an audience, whereas Rafe, watching and empathizing with Ralph Fiennes' character in this film is quite challenging. And so I think at the same time it's interesting, and also maybe it doesn't really work. I don't think that's necessarily his fault, but I'd be curious where you sit on this line from interesting and daring at one end to, like, actually, you know, maybe just fucking play it normally, you dickhead.
Well, again, I think it's also a writing problem, because he just, the whole film thinks it needs to be muted. And I think Fernando thinks that equates to realism.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know. He's having a full on breakdown, but he's having this internal one, and it doesn't chime together as a movie, and it's quite unsatisfying.
Hey, would you like to play a game with me?
Yes, please.
This is called the Ralph Fiennes IMDb rating game.
It's a riddle. Speak, friend, and enter. What's the Elvish word for friend?
Melon. So his first film is in 1992. It's Wuthering Heights. He plays Heathcliff, you know, which tells us something, doesn't it? It tells us that he was a leading man at the beginning of his career. It's got Juliette Binoche in.
Ooh.
It's directed by Peter Kosminski. It's a big deal because he's being sold. I mean, he's playing Heathcliff. He's being sold as, like, this dreamy leading man.
He's not being sold.
He's,
I mean, that's
being
just
sold.
Like,
come
that's,
on.
That's a Euro pudding. It's got Juliette Binoche.
All right, fine.
It's not a Hollywood film.
The year after.
Yeah.
Schindler's List.
Okay. Now you're talking.
Right. I mean,
that's it. That's the movie. This guy, everyone's like, okay.
Yeah. They've watched Wuthering Heights. They thought, let's get Heathcliff in charge of the concentration camp. That's what they've done. They said, that Heathcliff, he's playing it as leading man, but he's got really scary energy. Why don't we get him?
0 to 100 in a movie. Amazing.
There's also the Baby of Macon in between that in the same year. He plays the bishop's son, but never mind. We'll skip over that. You'll have to tell me some of these I don't know. So do you know the film Quiz Show? Yeah, he plays Charles Van Doren in that. That's the year after Schindler's List.
Yeah, good little flick that.
Okay.
Directed by Robert Redford.
Strange Days.
Ooh, yes, please.
Lenny Nero, that's 1995.
Very odd little flick, but yeah.
And then 1996, a film I watched on a train, The English Patient, which is incredibly long, quite complex, but, you know, good fun.
Yeah, what a run. This is such a run of flicks, so odd.
Well.
Watch Strange Days and go, you'd go, fuck, this is what Ralph does after Schindler's.
Rafe. This is what Rafe does. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll watch that. Okay. Then he's in a film called Oscar and Lucinda.
Right.
From 1997.
I never saw that. Yeah.
He's in a film called The Avengers in 1998. Not the one you're thinking of.
No, I'm thinking of the one that stars Ralph Fiennes.
No, I'm talking to the audience when I say that. But,
Sean Connery.
Yeah,
don't
sure.
talk to the audience. Talk to me.
Okay, fine.
Uma Thurman is in that. Oh, that was one of the turkeys of all time.
There we go.
By all accounts.
He plays the voice of Ramses and Jesus in two different films after this point. He's also in Sunshine in 1999.
Not the Danny Boyle.
Not,
of course.
Not the Danny Boyle.
And I'm telling the audience that, Joe. I'm not telling you.
Well, no, because I'm looking at his IMDb, so I know. That's the film, The Fate of a Hungarian Jewish Family Throughout the 20th Century. It's a Hungarian director. István Csabó. Maybe it is. Okay, beyond that, I'm not going to read them all out now because there's too many, okay? I mean, it's a fucking shitloads. One by one, I go, One Gin... The Miracle...
Oh, on Again.
On Again, Off Again. The Miracle Maker, The End of the Affair, How Proust Can
End
Change Your
affair.
Life. Is The End of the Affair good?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's based on the book of the same name by Graham Greene.
Great. Spider?
Yes, that's a Cronenberg flick. Very odd. Didn't enjoy that one.
The Red Dragon, he's in.
Yeah, he plays Francis Dolarhyde, the
that's
serial
right.
killer.
He does. And then in the same year, he's in Made in Manhattan.
Oh, my days. What?
Very confusing.
Very confusing. He's gone Hollywood at that point.
Then we hit Constant Gardener. Well, there's Chromophobia, and there's the Chum Scrubber, and there's 10 Days to D-Day, a TV movie that he narrates. So, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of confusing stuff. And then I think you might be right, because after the Constant Gardener, in 2005, he appears for the first time in the Harry Potter films as Lord Voldemort. That's what he's doing at that
for the
point.
Next 10
that's his
years.
Bread and butter. Yeah, and then he does that in between the Harry Potter films, which actually, you're right, kind of last him in terms of release until 2011. Other things he does in between, he does Land of the Blind, Bernard and Doris. He does In Bruges, of course, the famous character and his cunt fucking kids.
like, don't call my cunt fucking kids cunts. What's he say? What's the line?
you take that back about my cunt fucking kids.
Yeah.
He then plays the Duke that Keira Knightley gets married off to in The Duchess in a very, like, that is a fucking shit film, by the way, I think. But
I remember quite liking that when I saw it.
Yeah, I tried to watch it again about a year, no, not even, less than a year ago, since I've lived in this house, and it's just so boring. Then he's in The Hurt Locker. So within Bruges and The Hurt Locker, we're starting to see what you said, like he's picking interesting side roles where he's showing up for a short period of time and in some ways stealing the film. He's in The Reader as well.
Oh, he pops, like, Hurt Locker is Kathryn Bigelow, and he'd been in Strange Days, directed by Kathryn Bigelow.
There you go. So she's reading that, she's making that film, and she goes, I know who's perfect for this role. It's Rafe. Let's get Rafe, right?
I genuinely love that. I love it when
it comes together.
Yeah, I'd love to work with Kathryn again. Oh, Kathryn was on the phone.
He's so fantastic in that film. Do you remember what he does in Hurt Locker?
Yeah, fantastic.
For audiences that don't remember, he plays a person who you assume is either like a British Secret Service or ex-British military, now like private contractor, conflict contractor for a private company that have an interest in oil in the Middle East or whatever. He runs into Jeremy Renner in the middle of a gunfight, and he's so believable and so masculine that the idea that that is the same guy that he's in this film.
Constant Gardener.
It's unreal that he's the same person.
That's the speed. That's the fines I want. You know, that you get a little taste of it in Hurt Locker, and I'm like, I want that movie.
You want action hero fines. I want action. Well, listen, man, I'm skipping ahead, but I won't skip ahead. We'll circle back to this. By the way, there's so fucking many films. Jesus Christ. Clash of the Titans, Nanny McPhee, Cemetery Junction he's in.
Oh dear, with Ricky Gervais's.
Coriolanus he's in as well, which he's terrific in.
With Jerry Butler, he directed that as well.
Page 8, which is the TV movie Page 8, which I think they turned into a real film later, didn't they?
Yeah, that's one of those whistleblower ones as well, isn't it?
Yeah, he's the original in that, and then when they redo it, it's with Bill Nye, isn't it?
Back again with Bill Nye.
Can't remember. Wrath of the Titans, Great Expectations, Skyfall, so he starts to show up in Bond as well. He does a couple of voices in Wallace and Gromit films as well, a couple of different Wallace and Gromit films. And then, 2014, all of a sudden, he's bang centre of a Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yes.
Which is the best Wes Anderson film. And it's because Ralph Fiennes is in it. That's why it's the best Wes Anderson film. Because he's actually a good actor, not like all the other people they have in Wes Anderson films who are just quirky, indie, alternative people.
And here we go, the Wes Anderson game. Who is in a Wes Anderson movie who then is never in another Wes Anderson movie?
Is it Tom Hanks?
Is it Ralph Fiennes? Or is it all the other hacks who love to shovel up and eat the dog food bowl that Wes goes, chum's coming, guys, come and snuffle at my trough.
Like, fucking Jesus Christ. anyway, I'm skipping over a bunch of stuff. Then in 2015, he's in a terrific film, A Bigger Splash, which I think that's the beginning of his reinvention into the modern era. That's the first of new finds.
Yeah, but he's not the main.
He's not the main, but he is like... He's the charisma of that film. Like, he's the reason that film... Without him, that is just another random Tilda Swinton movie, right?
Yeah.
He is fucking incredible in that film.
But that's like that's him, the equivalent of Ben Kingsley in Sexy Beast. Him coming in and...
Oh, yeah, sure. I thought you were about to... Yeah, because we've had a conversation previously about In Bruges and Ralph Fiennes, where we're saying we've agreed that he's just kind of is just doing the Ben Kingsley thing.
Oh, no, he's doing something completely different in A Bigger Splash. Sure. Do you know what? I confuse things there. I've confused things. No, but yeah, he's doing that thing where yeah he's the spice for the whole movie.
Oh my god! do you remember the scene in that film where he shows up? There's a couple of neighbors of Tilda Swinton and her young boyfriend. So he's the ex boyfriend of Tilda Swinton. He's much closer to her age. He's sort of playing late 50s, and her new boyfriend is in his 30s, and he showed up and he's staying at their villa in the middle of nowhere in Spain. It's like arid and hot. And there are a couple of their neighbors and friends come round and he's just holding court in the living room as only Ralph Fiennes as this character could do. He is a music executive from the music industry. He's got all these stories about the Rolling Stones and meeting the Beatles, and he's wowing the neighbors and friends with these stories. He puts a record on and he starts to dance. And at the beginning, it seems absurd and silly and ridiculous. And after a few seconds, he's the sexiest guy you've ever seen. And he's doing this entirely believable, cool dance that all the people around him are entranced by. You know, Ralph Fiennes, he's fantastic. Watch it for the dance alone.
I'll rewatch that.
Hail Caesar is there in there as well. Beyond that, we've got The White Crow from 2018, which I really rate. I think that's a fantastic film about ballet during the Cold War era.
He's not the main guy in that, right?
Not at all. He plays an old Russian ballet teacher. I think he directed it, yeah. But it's an exquisite film. It really is. It's beautiful. Then he's in Holmes and Watson, weirdly enough. The Will Ferrell and...
He'll be throwing in a comic turn for a little bit of bunts.
Well, and he repeats the feat in the Lego Movie 2, of course, as well. Then there's a few more. James Bonds, The King's Men, The Menu, which was a big movie.
Pause on The King's Men. This is the... flick that's like
in the early years of the 20th century, the Kingsman Agency is formed to stand against a cabal plotting a war to wipe out millions of people. Is this a prequel of the Kingsman?
That's exactly what it is. And Ralph is the hero of it.
You called him Ralph.
he's the action hero of that flick.
Is it good?
He's the Colin for absolutely not. I couldn't stand more than 20 minutes of it. Appalling film. An absolute turd.
Right.
And I've seen The Kingsman really and Kingsman 2 Golden Circle or whatever the fuck to completion. I could not stand to finish the movie The King's Man.
Got it.
But this is not Ralph's fault. But like we've been waiting for him to finally unfurl into a big old action flick, and that's what we got.
Well, there it was. Okay, and then he's in Conclave in 2024, for which he's nominated for Best Actor Oscar, and he is.
You suggested that he was back big time, baby. Back in the big time is the main guy.
No, that's not what I said. I didn't say he's back in the big time. I said he's back as the star of films.
For one movie.
No, not one.
Yes, one.
No.
Conclave.
There's four. He's the star of four movies from this point onwards.
Oh, okay. Shit, fuck. Here we go.
Yeah. The next one is The Return, where he plays Odysseus, which came out in 2024 also.
No one saw that.
It doesn't matter. He's the star of the film. It doesn't matter. I didn't say that these were big films. I said he is the star of these films. Okay. Right. And if we really want to, you know, then
who's the co-star of The Return?
I don't know her name.
She's
famous.
He's not the star. He's the co-star with someone else. It's like Binoche. It's Fiennes and
It's Binoche.
Right. I fucking nailed it. I knew it was Binoche.
Charlie Plummer's in it as well.
It's Fines and Binoche. If you're trying to package... If I'm a sales agent and I'm packaging a movie and someone goes, I've got Ralph Fiennes and The Return and some French actress you've never heard of. And I'd go, no, I'm not buying that. And they'd go, oh, hang on a sec. I've got a phone call. It's Juliette Binoche and it's Ralph Fiennes. And I go, yes, yes, yes. Wee, wee, wee.
Then he's in 28 Years Later, not claiming he's the star of that. Shut your fucking mouth. Then he's in The Choral, which he is the star of again. He's the star of a British ensemble film, but he's still the star of it.
Not sold on. It goes back to opening a flick. That film was not sold on the name Ralph Fiennes.
Your definitions of this. No, I'm actually getting annoyed now. I'm getting annoyed with you now. You're pushing a boundary that I'm getting annoyed with. What I'm saying is that he's the lead in these films. He went from being the lead in things to not being the lead in things for a long time to being the lead in things again. That's what I said. I'm using the word star with lead interchangeably, and you're burying up a definition. Which is making it impossible for me to do my job.
I apologize. Thank you for calling me up on that. But do you understand the needle that I've, my problem that I've got about why you're using that interchangeably? And I don't mean to pick you up on it. But
you sound like me in an argument with my wife. He's the lead in these films.
He is, but the films are not sold.
And then the reason I said star is also because he's not the lead in all of them, but he's the most interesting part of them all.
Right, don't say star then. Just say...
Well, okay, no, fine, but in 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple, for example, like, he's the man on the poster. I know that you've got that young scallywag, whatever his name is, in the driving seat, but Ralph Fiennes is really... He is really the name that they say is the name of the film for this film that needs a name. It's his. And he's on the poster.
Because he's got the art house actor cred and people enjoyed him and that they have used his name to the concept.
He's back, baby. Anyway, let's play the Ralph Fiennes game. That was just us going through. This is going to take 2 minutes, okay? The game here is this Ralph Fiennes film over 7 stars or under 7 stars rated on IMDb? Okay? Now we'll start with an easy one, Schindler's List.
Over.
It's on 9. Okay. Oh, I tell you what we could do. Let's not do that game. Let's do the higher or lower with Ralph Fiennes films rating game. Okay, so easy start. Schindler's List is a 9. Then we go to The English Patient. Is it lower or higher?
Lower, and I'm going to say 8. Actually, I think it's dated maybe. 7.9?
It's 7.4. Okay.
Ooh, okay.
Then we hit The Avengers, where he plays John Steed in 19...
Lower, and that'll be 4.1.
It's 3.8, even lower than that. Okay.
Can I get a bit more, like excitement when I get close to guessing?
Well, I'm giving you easy ones at the beginning. They're gonna get really hard in a minute.
I said I bet that's 4.1 and it was 3.8. Okay. Fuck.
Yeah, sure. I'm still a little salty from what happened before, so
you were using star and lead interchangeably to a made far, in rather Manhattan. Egregious
made
effect.
In Manhattan. Is it higher or lower than the film The Avengers?
Give me space to give both answers here. Mm-hmm. Higher. And I would say it's rated at 6.4.
It's rated at 5.4.
Okay, I've got that to a degree that's unacceptable, so I won't accept. But yes, it's higher.
That's a 5.4. Okay, next we are going to The Constant Gardener.
Higher, and I'd say that's a 7.3.
You know it's a 7.3. Do you? You must have seen it's a 7.3. No, have you?
Full on guess that. It's a 7.0. I'm not. I don't follow. I'm not on a.
Let me do it again. Hold on. Oh my god! Very good. No, it's exactly. It's exactly a 7.3.
It's plum 7.3.
It's going to get hard now. Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Is that higher or lower than The Constant Gardener?
I don't know. And the goblet of fire.
It's Dumbledore's. It's Voldemort's first turn.
Goblet. I reckon probably it's more well regarded than 7.3. I'm going to say higher. It's 7.8.
It's 7.7. Very close. Very close. Now you don't get this. You don't get the same level of excitement now because I just told you it was hard. No, listen. I just told you it was hard, so you know. You know it's around the same area. Okay.
Okay.
You know it's around the same area. Right. Then, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, is that lower or higher than the Goblet of Fire? I think that's the second best film.
Yeah, you do, but no one else does.
I do, but no one else does.
It's so I'd say it's lower, and it's 7.5?
It's 7.5.
Oh, yes, baby. Yes.
Okay, now this is really hard. This is really hard.
If I lose, is it the end of the game?
Yeah.
Oh,
no, it's not. In Bruges. Is In Bruges higher or lower than the Order of the Phoenix? It's really hard, this.
It can't be. I mean, it has to be higher, and I'd say it's higher. And I would say it's a 7. If it's ludicrous, it's not. You're saying it's hard, but I mean, it has to be higher than 7.7, and it has to be.
Well, it was 7.5 that was the Order of the
7.5. So, yeah, In Bruges has to be higher. It has to be. I mean, In Bruges.
I'm not helping you. I'm just making faces.
In Bruges is higher than 7.5. It's at least 7.9.
Well, okay, you just said to me, like, yeah, you like it, but other people.
Everyone loves In Bruges.
Well, yeah, a certain type of person loves In Bruges, but not everyone. I met someone over the weekend who said that they thought it was a bit violent.
What is this IMDb rating based on? Isn't it critics?
Popular vote. No.
Popular votes. Is it everyone?
I guess you can go on and vote them, yeah.
Oh, well, then if it's everyone. What are we on? 7.5?
7.5 for Order of the Phoenix.
Maybe In Bruges is too violent and it splits people and it's lower and it's 7.3?
Oh, you idiot. It's higher. It's 7.9.
Oh, you're such a cunt. Joe's won the game, everyone.
No,
guess who's won the game. It's Joe's won the game.
You would have guessed that. We all know you would have guessed that. Okay, 7.9 from In Bruges. This one's really fun. This is fun now. This is fun now. I promise you this is fun now, okay? The Hurt Locker. Is the Hurt Locker higher or lower than In Bruges? Catherine Bigelow ate my bigger toe. Big blob dibbido hip hop.
Yep, dip dibba dip. I would say Hurt Locker has got more broader appeal. More people would like it over In Bruges. And so I'd say it's higher, and it's 8.2.
It's not higher. Lower. It's 7.5. Yeah. Ooh. But I think that might just be Jim Cameron on here over and over again with different email addresses voting it down at one star to get it to go lower. Okay, that was the Hurt Locker at 7.5. Let's roll right up to a more recent time. And we'll say A Bigger Splash. Is the Hurt Locker higher or lower than A Bigger Splash? 7.5.
A Bigger Splash is higher than 7.5, I would say.
Are you giving it a score?
8.2.
It's not. It's 6.4. That's a lot of people who've misunderstood the film, I think, right? Okay, well, how about this then? We go from A Bigger Splash, which is
6.4,
to 28 years later.
That's got to be higher. That's got to be 7.
It is higher, but it's only 6.6.
6.6.
Whereas The Bone Temple was 7.3, interestingly, so people seem to prefer that one to the original one. Or the people who didn't like the first one didn't watch the second one and therefore didn't vote it anything, you know. How about that? There we go. Well, that was it. That was the Ralph Fiennes game. You played quite well.
Thank you. I'm quite happy with that.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question, Joe?
Yeah?
Just one thing before we get on to the other bit of business about box office. What do you think about the word, or like calling a film worthy? Oh, that film was so worthy.
Right.
The notion of worthy.
Worthiness.
It's a little worthy. And it's quite interesting that she sees a mother and a son coming back from a clinic. And she's like, can you pick them up? Like, they're going to have to walk like 15 miles home. And he's like, no, I need to look after you. Sorry, this is the one time he draws the line. And I think that's a valid question to ask about, like, oh, you can't help everyone, so help no one. And you, if you can't, and also if you try to help anyone, someone might call you a white savior. Yeah, do you know what? Best, I won't do anything. It's easier to not do any of that. And I'll just leave it. I'll just leave it because it's just actually not worth the hassle. That is the, you know, that's the kind of, that's just where a lot of people get left. And in this film, it doesn't, you know, that particular angle doesn't get covered. But that's kind of where the argument...
That's the central argument of the film.
Yeah, and at the end, Ralph finally realises, like, that's a wonderful revelation of, like, I can help this girl.
And yeah, he still can't.
He can't.
He actually isn't allowed to.
Which is also fair, because he would be, you know, you're like, what are the logistics of him saving one little orphan girl?
What are you going to do with her afterwards? Yeah. Are you coming on to a point?
No. Because
I want to make one more point if you're done.
You make one more point. But so the word, so there was something about, I think we're on different sides of the same coin, because there's a worthiness around the movie, The Constant Gardener.
It feels like a film that thinks it's doing a good job. It feels like a film that thinks it's investigative journalism, but it actually isn't. It's just a film.
And it's telling you something about how the world really works. And it's like, open your eyes, guys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But if it wanted to do that, then it should have been a more mainstream film so that ordinary people would actually enjoy it and then might learn something about how, you know, people of Africa are exploited.
Or just do a documentary. Or
with Ralph Fiennes. I'd watch that.
Yeah. But then maybe John Le Carré's to blame. Because, I mean, really, John Le Carré, we haven't talked anything about John Le Carré.
I don't know anything about John Le Carré, really.
Well, he writes kind of stiff upper lipped spy novels that are kind of feel quite down to earth and kind of the anti Bond.
Right.
And, there'll be some kind of shenanigans, some kind of big. Right. Shenanigans going on around it.
I mean, I'm always hearing his name to the extent where I wish he would John Le Carré himself out of my fucking purview. You know what I mean?
Well, I've read a couple of his books. Some of them I've liked, some of them I haven't.
Yeah.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the book I started reading, couldn't get on with. The movie starring Gary Oldman.
Great.
Fucking fantastic. Love it.
Great film. Yeah.
But so he's, but for a, I don't know, it's weird, like a novel feels like it doesn't get held to the same regard, because I met, like, John Le Carré would have done his research, it would have been packed with detail. But, like, no one reads books anyway, so it's not like he's exposing anything.
Right.
But then when you have a movie, millions of dollars worth movie starring Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah.
And it just feels like, oh, by the way, guys, did you know this is happening in Africa?
Whoa.
It's like fucking...
Well, also, and I think there are other examples of films that, you know, that can be worthy and also for a mainstream audience where the accessibility actually makes the whole thing, you know, worth a while, not just worthy. So I'm thinking, for example, of like Avengers Endgame, which brought, you know, the idea to the world that if we did let that guy, that blue guy, have all the different colored stones, that actually half of us could disappear. And so, you know, sometimes making a film and making it accessible, making it for kids, allows people to see it. And a lot of people saw that film that was very successful. And then that blue guy, you know, I think Gargamel stepped on him or something.
But also, like, you know, The Dark Knight. Okay.
Right.
Christopher Nolan, he brings to the masses this notion, okay, this kind of prisoner's dilemma, although I don't think it's called that.
No.
You know, you're on a ship.
Yeah.
Okay. With a load of fucking horrible criminals.
Yeah.
And there's a bomb. And you can kill them. And if you don't kill them, they're going to kill you or something.
They might
whatever.
Kill you. Yeah.
They might kill you. You got to make a choice. Okay, and Christopher Nolan is bringing that to the masses, and people can think, actually, do you know what?
Yeah.
And as the film says, you can't do that. You can't
right.
say, kill these prisoners, they're nothing, just because they're criminals. You can't. Yeah. And he does that. He dumbs it down so even the thickest of thickos.
Look at you, you fucking idiot. You thought that the people would kill each other. You're wrong, Joker. You're wrong, Joker.
And just when he like he does play into racial stereotypes, does old Christopher Nolan, because he gets the biggest, the largest of black actors there is to come over, to loom over to a tiny, caring white person. And as an audience,
that is quite an uncomfortable scene.
You're thinking, oh my days.
Yeah.
Everything I'd feared. Oh no, I wonder what's going to happen.
In the script, it's Chris Nolan's like, yeah. Now, for this, it's very important that you find the biggest black guy you can so that everyone watching the film knows, they know that this guy is going to do it. Because not only are many of the other criminals here black, but because he's the biggest one physically, the audience will know that he will have the bravery to push the button, you know? And then we'll pull the cloak back. And then we'll point the finger at the audience and say, no, it was you that was racist, audience. It was you. Are you ashamed of yourself? Are you ashamed of yourself, audience?
Yeah. You absolute scum. I can't believe you thought this guy.
And you thought the Joker, you agreed with the Joker. You thought these people were going to blow each other up. And guess what? They haven't done. And so actually, not only are you racist, but you're wrong about society. Racist wrong.
In a movie that I wrote and directed, so it was decided all of this anyway. I'm in total control here, guys. You fell for it.
That's true. That film actually loses a whole star on IMDb because of that.
No, do you know what? It gains a star because that's the scene that Mark Kermode goes, no, actually, I think this is where the movie falls down. You're like, actually, Mark Kermode, the fact that you think this is where the movie falls down actually is where it wins and actually becomes a masterpiece and you're a fucking moron.
And therein lies the definition of this podcast.
A long time ago, I was in Burma. My friends and I were working for the local government. They were trying to buy the loyalty of tribal leaders by bribing them with precious stones. But their caravans were being raided in a forest north of Rangoon by a bandit. So we went looking for the stones. But in 6 months, we never met anyone who traded with him. One day, I saw a child playing with a ruby the size of a tangerine. The bandit had been throwing them away.
So why steal it?
Well, because he thought it was good sport, because some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world.
Okay, do you want to play the box office game?
Oh, would I ever?
This is
going to be
tricky.
Tricky business.
And there's some worth saying at this stage as well, there's some absolutely stunning cinematography in this film. The scenes of the birds over the Red Canyon lakes, I mean I think that it reminded me of, have you ever seen The Sheltering Sky?
No, with Tommy Lee Jones?
No, with John Malkovich.
Oh, I always thought Tommy Lee Jones. I was confused.
Well, they're kind of similar, those guys. Tommy Lee Jones and John Malkovich are kind of similar. Deborah Winger in that film as well.
Is she one of the birds? Deborah Winger, she's a wonderful bird.
She's very fast and she puts crosses into the box. It's an American married couple, Port and Kit Moresby, journey purposelessly through northern Africa, hoping to encounter moments which will revitalize their increasingly soulless relationship. It's a film, I think.
Hello, where do they go? Sorry, hang on a sec.
They go to North Africa.
Okay, I'm just going to take some notes. What else do they do?
Oh, right, I see. Is this a joke? This is a fun joke, is it?
Oh, that's quite fun. What else do they do about their listless marriage?
they go to North Africa and they just look around.
Yeah.
They start in Tunisia. Oh, I see what you're doing now. You're taking notes for your own soulless marriage. I misunderstood that. Well, they start in Tunisia and they go to the places where the other tourists are. They sit in a cafe where there's a couple of other white people, and then they go, "Oh, this is too sterile for us in here." So they go deeper and deeper and deeper into the deserts of North Africa. Anyway, this film, the reason it reminded me of it is because it's kind of color palette red. It reminds me a lot of the cinematography of this film. I'm aware that Kenya and North Africa are quite far apart, but it looks striking. It's one of the best looking films I've ever seen. The Sheltering Sky. It's absolutely. It made a huge impression on me, partly because it's beautiful, and partly because while the first half is this. Is this haunting, delicate, sort of internal story of these two people trying to explore their relationship and themselves? The second half is a brutal, punishing film about illness and death, and it's just I didn't see it coming at all, and I kept hanging on in there thinking. Some of that beauty from the first half is going to come back and rear its head again, and it just never does. It's so worth watching, by the way, as far as cinematic experience goes. It's 2 hours 18 minutes, so you're gonna need a little bit of time, but I would highly recommend it as an experience.
It's one of my favorite things to do when someone talks about Africa, or I go. Actually, Africa's a continent. What are you talking about? Do you mean Kenya, or do you mean Zimbabwe or Nigeria? Well, you know, where do you actually mean? You know, it's Africa is actually a continent. You know, be more specific.
Right.
Would you just say Europe when you meant France? I think not. I think not. You massive racist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So with the fact that you've just lobbed in there, I'm aware these two places in Africa are very far apart. Together. Before you pen that email, dear the movies, you forgot podcast in episode.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sorry,
if I were to list like various countries in Africa, could you tell me whether they were in the south, the east, the west, the whole other?
No, veto. Let's play the box office game.
Where's Kenya? Do you know where Kenya is? Do you know where Kenya is?
No.
You don't know where Kenya is?
Of course not. I have no idea.
Fair enough. It's not in North Africa, but it's not as far from North Africa as you can be in Africa. Because, of course, that would be South Africa. Now, let's play the box office game. Budget brackets estimated, per favore, for the movie The Constant Gardener. Now, what do they spend on a flick like this?
Well, it's got a Hollywood studio attached. When I watched it, it kind of said Sony something, I think, as I recall. There's some Bujo for the location work. Got a couple of big stars, but it's still kind of Euro money, like 20 mil?
25 mil. I think that's a very good guess. Pat yourself on the back for that.
20? Thanks.
Okay,
thanks.
Opening weekend, US and Canada. It was September the 4th, 2005. What does this movie take on its opening weekend?
I don't think much. It's not getting a big spread. You might get some highbrow Americans going, oh, is that the guy from Schindler's List? Hey, Barb, have you seen the guy from Schindler's List is gone to Africa and he's going to go save some guys in Africa now.
Yeah.
Oh, no, wait, Barb, I don't think he did the saving in the, movie. I think he was the bad guy.
The bad guy.
2 million?
Weirdly enough, it made 8.5 million.
Wow.
Which I don't really understand, but I guess maybe there was a big advertising effort behind it, a big marketing push.
From the director of City of God?
I guess maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. City of God came out, 3 years before and was huge?
I can imagine some very baffled, very grumpy Americans.
Yeah.
How dare they go after Big Pharma? How dare they?
Well, gross worldwide. Let's come to it.
Well, Vice is knocking about The Oscar chat.
Oscar chat.
It's getting an Oscar bump.
Well, she certainly had an Oscar bump when she got out of the bath, you know, because she was pregnant.
Do you think that, not a real bump. I think that's just...
Of course not. Of course not a real bump.
Well, it might
have
been.
It's not a real bump.
No, it doesn't look like one, but, you know. Probably did okay. Like, maybe 70 mil?
Not bad. 82 mil.
82 mil, yeah.
It's not bad. I mean, this flick made money.
That's it's a very decent return on an overlong, quite unengaging movie.
Totally. How about it, huh? There you go. All right. Well, let's move on and never discuss it again.
Okay. Should we do the bit of the show where one of us reads out a list of movies they forgot, with a view to catching out the other one on a movie they forgot to pick our next episode?
Yeah.
Now, for new listeners, this is where this time it's me, I'm going to read a list of five movies. I've got five chances to catch Joe out on a movie he forgot. He has to have forgot. He forgot it.
Mm-hmm. And what happens if I haven't? What happens if you don't get me?
Oh, if he hasn't forgot, he forgot it. Joe can just go, right, you didn't get me, and then we do his movie. And the movie he's picked for us to do, if I don't get him out, is...
Space Cowboys. The fantastic film Space Cowboys. That's my default. That's my punishment for you, if you fail to get me in five turns. So have at it, sir.
Punishment? I mean, I can't wait to watch Space Cowboys.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic. It's a fantastic film.
Okay, here we go. The Virgin Suicides.
Never seen it. Get out of here with that Sofia Coppola mess. I've never seen it. I don't know if it's a mess. I just,
you know. Really? Lucky you. Lucky.
Well, it's got what's her face in it, hasn't it?
Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah, it's got Dunsty. Dunstable. Dunstable cursed.
Dunstables. Where are your Dunstables?
They're really Dunkables.
Tricky Business. Okay. What the thing is, what do I want to watch? I don't want to watch any of these.
It's always the game within the game, isn't it? This is for new listeners, if we're doing it. The first game is, what can I get the other person on that they forgot? But the game within the game is always, but do I actually want to watch that? The answer is often no.
The suggestion is we need to do more subtitled movies and more animated movies. We barely do any animated movies. And there's a reason for that, right? It's quite
hard. I was gonna try and get you on an animated movie next week. But
oh yeah, well, because the Discord channel has gifted you how to get me.
Yeah, in the same way that the emails constantly gift you ways to get me. You claimed email, I claimed Discord.
No, because the emails don't know you. I know you.
What? But the Discord don't know you. I know you.
Yeah, but I'm on Discord going, yeah, this is Plum. You've got me. Oh, Joe could get me on this.
All right, go on.
I want to do something fun. Kick-Ass.
Well, the thing is, I feel a bit resentful about it because I've tried to get you on it a couple of times and you've said no both times. Now you're turning it around. You think now that's for me now, do you? That's now you think that's for me now. Because would you not think me trying to get you on it would show you that I haven't forgotten it? I think I'm saying no to that.
All right,
one,
fair enough. You
and with a little bit of sass.
You seem upset. Okay, sorry. I thought you'd have a little bit more humility about these things.
No, I'm humorless.
Oh man, I need a bit of fun. I need a bit of fun after the Constant Gardener, for Christ's sake.
I know, it's just what you think is fun and what I think is fun is often different.
What do you think is fun?
I think
National Treasure is fun.
No, I didn't think that was fun. No. No. What's the last thing we did that was fun? Let me look. The last thing we did that was fun that wasn't like, you know, Project Hail Mary. For me,
here we go.
I wouldn't describe The Godfather as fun, although I did enjoy it. I would say the last thing that we did that was fun was The Patriot. And that was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 episodes ago. And before that, the last thing that we did that was fun before was Brokeback Mountain, and that was 12 episodes before that. I think we very rarely do fun films, but I don't think you would consider those to be fun.
No, I didn't have huge amounts of fun. I love the episodes, though. Okay, so I'm two in. Yeah. I'm two in, right? Okay. Yeah. I'm going to start saying things. I think I hold back from saying things that I think or forgot you forgot, and I think that's my mistake. So I'm now going to say one. Gattaca. Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly not a forgot you forgot, right? For me, no, personally, no. Because I've seen it several times. No, okay, but I think generally, I think people have forgotten that.
That's what I know. That's why I said it.
But I haven't forgotten that. Are you looking at your DVDs? Is that what's happening? You're looking at your DVDs.
Yeah, I am. Like, well, because I'm just trying to give some. I need some spice in there.
All right, go on. Usually, listeners, it's me that hasn't prepared my list, and today it's Adam. This is a great joy for me.
I've got one in my locker that I'll win on.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, sure.
Seven Psychopaths. In Bruges, deformed, forgotten, older brother.
Yeah. I tried to get you on that very early on in this podcast.
Right. I've forgotten that.
Years ago. And you said no, you hadn't forgotten it, and you said it was shit, and that you didn't think it qualified as a forget you forgot because it was too shit to qualify.
But I've forgotten how shit it was, and I think it's a forgot. I don't think people consider it. I considered it shit, but I don't think the world's considered it shit. I want to get one that you want, actually. I want to get one that...
You're going dark? Are you thinking
no,
dark?
No, I'm not. I want to get something that you'd like. I'm trying to please you.
Yeah. Yeah, please me. Please feed me Seymour.
Paths of Glory?
I don't think I've ever seen Paths of Glory.
It's the Kubrick anti-war flick.
Yeah, oh. I've never seen it. Nice suggestion, though.
It's nice. Okay, imagine I haven't said Seven Psychopaths, okay? So.
Okay, yeah. So that was your fourth one.
Jesus Christ. Jesus.
Christmas Day.
I'm going to do it.
You got one. You're pulling the trigger.
Well, I'm genuinely trying to get something... Bun. I'm trying to please you.
Okay.
I don't want to watch.
Yeah.
But I'm just letting go of the game now. High Fidelity.
Oh,
I haven't pleased him. Well, it feels like a loss. He's making the face.
No. I can't lose because we can't watch Space Cowboys this soon, can we? That's just, that feels
not,
wrong.
What's that face? Do you not, have you not forgotten it?
I fucking hate that film. It's so shit. And I've watched it about seven times.
It's Space Cowboys, then.
I mean, you know, you were saying you wanted to watch something fun after Constant Gardener. I promise you, Space Cowboys is fun. Is it a good film? I don't know. That's to be determined by you. Is it interesting? I don't know. Again, you will determine that. Is it fun? Well, now... Again, you will have to determine that. For me, it's fun, for sure. I find it fun because it's got Donald Sutherland in it, and it's got Clint Eastwood in it, and it's got Tommy Lee Jones in it, and it's got that other guy that we all know, whose name is what, again?
Never heard of him.
James
Garner. It's James Garner.
Yeah. James Garner, the Nottingham Forest
midfielder. That's all I'm
going to
be talking about when we do Space Cowboys. It's James Garner, and we're going to dig in on Garner.
Yeah, great. I can't wait to do that. And it's just, look, man, it's a barrel of laughs. We want to watch these old boys take on some young astronauts. And it's Clint at his best, you know? It's really a cracking movie. It's a cracking film, Gromit.
It's some good old boys. Never need no harm.
Okay, hey, if I ask you a question now, I bet you'll be able to get it, right? If I tell you, do you know the film is about them going into space, right? Or like potentially.
Yeah.
What song do you think they definitely use in the film?
Them going into space?
Well, yeah, because these guys have grown up like being obsessed with the moon landing and all that stuff. Like
Bowie, Starman?
No, that's good. That's good. But no, think that's too British for this film. It's Clint Eastwood. That's a little bit.
Whenever you sing a song, I have no idea.
It's like free. Let me do it again.
Keep going.
In other words,
please be doomed.
I love you. Yeah. What's the first line of that song?
Take me to the moon. Take me to the moon, and darling, take me to the stars. Take me to Jupiter and Mars. Hello, can you take me to the moon?
Hello, is this a taxi service for intergalactic space? I want to go to the moon.
No, there's a couple of extra stops after, please. So,
oh, good, because I was about to tell you that's not intergalactic, that's just galactic, that's within the galaxy.
Oh, I tell you what, I can imagine him going intergalactic, planetary. Someone's whispered into Clint Eastwood's ear, Clint. We want this movie to play across all age ranges. Can you play this? Right, he's like, right, no, right. Play fucking Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin. Take me to the moon and
fly me to the moon. Stop saying take me to the moon.
Oh,
that's so
blue
stupid.
Moon. I'd like to fly to the moon. I'd like to go to the stars. And Jupiter to the moon. Yes.
Wow, man. Your recall of some of the most popular songs of all time is just incredible.